Chapter 8. The recovery to the visiting stranger Hillbridge's first question was, "Have you seen Keniston's things?" Keniston took precedence of the Colonial State House, the Gilbert Stuart Washington and the Ethnological Museum. Nay, he ran neck and neck with the president of the university, a prehistoric relic who had known Emerson, and who was still sent about the country in cotton wool to open educational institutions with a toothless oration on Brook Farm. Keniston was sent about the country too. He opened art exhibitions, laid the foundation of academies, and acted in a general sense as the spokesman and apologist of art. Hillbridge was proud of him in his peripatetic character, but his fellow townsmen let it be understood that to now Keniston one must come to Hillbridge. Never was work more dependent for its effect on atmosphere, on milieu. Hillbridge was Keniston's milieu, and there was one lady, a devotee of his art, who went so far as to assert that once, at an exhibition in New York, as he had passed a Keniston without recognizing it. "I it simply didn't want to be seen in such surroundings. It was hiding itself under an incognito," she declared. It was a source of special pride to Hillbridge that it contained all the artist's best works. Strangers were told that Hillbridge had discovered them. The discovery had come about in the simplest manner. Professor Driffert, who had a reputation for olecting, had one day hung a sketch on his drawing room wall, and thereafter Mrs. Driffert's visitors, always a little flurried by the sense that it was the kind of house in which one might be suddenly called upon to distinguish between a dry point and an etching, or between Raffles and Raffles Sanzio, were not infrequently subjected to the professor's offhand inquiry, "By the way, have you seen my Keniston?" The visitors, perceptibly awed, would retreat to a critical distance and murmur the usual guarded generalities while they tried to keep the name in mind long enough to look it up in the encyclopedia. The name was not in the encyclopedia, but, as a compensating fact, it became known that the man himself was in Hillbridge. Hillbridge, then, owned an artist whose celebrity it was the proper thing to take for granted. Someone else, emboldened by the thought, bought a Keniston, and the next year, on the occasion of the president's golden jubilee, the faculty, by unanimous consent, presented him with a Keniston. 2 years later there was a Keniston exhibition, to which the art critics came from New York and Boston, and not long afterward a well-known Chicago collector vainly attempted to buy Professor Driffert's sketch, which the art journals cited as a rare example of the painter's first or silvery manner. Thus there gradually grew up a small circle of connoisseurs known in artistic circles as men who collected Kenistons. Professor Wildmarsh, of the Chair of Fine Arts and Archaeology, was the first critic to publish a detailed analysis of the master's methods and purpose. The article was illustrated by engravings which, though they had cost the magazine a fortune, were declared by Professor Wildmarsh to give but an imperfect suggestion of the esoteric significance of the originals. The professor, with a tact that contrived to make each reader feel himself included among the exceptions, went on to say that Keniston's work would never appeal to any but exceptional natures, and he closed with the usual assertion that to apprehend the full meaning of the master's essay it was necessary to see him in the surroundings of his own home at Hillbridge. Professor Wildmarsh's article was read one spring afternoon by a young lady just speeding eastward on her first visit to Hillbridge, and already flushed with anticipation of the intellectual opportunities awaiting her. In East Onondaga, where she lived, Hillbridge was looked on as an Oxford. Magazine writers, with the easy American use of the superlative, designated it as the venerable alma mater, the deep seat of learning, and Claudia Day had been brought up to regard it as the fountainhead of knowledge, and of that mental distinction which is so much rarer than knowledge. An innate passion for all that was thus distinguished and exceptional made her revere Hillbridge as the native soil of those intellectual amenities that were of such difficult growth in the thin air of East Onondaga. At the first suggestion of a visit to Hillbridge, whither she went at the invitation of a girlfriend who, incredible apotheosis, had married one of the university professors, Claudia's spirit dilated with a sense of new possibilities. The vision of herself walking under the historic elms toward the Memorial Library, standing rapt before the Stuart Washington, or drinking in, from some obscure corner of an academic drawing room, the president's reminiscences of the Concord group, this vividness of self-projection into the emotions awaiting her made her glad of any delay that prolonged so exquisite a moment. It was in this mood that she opened the article on Keniston. She knew about him, of course. She was wonderfully held up, even for East Onondaga. As he had read of him in the magazines, as he had met, on a visit to New York, a man who collected Kenistons, and a photogravure of a Keniston in an artistic frame hung above her writing table at home. But Professor Wildmarsh's article made her feel how little she really knew of the master, and she trembled to think of the state of relative ignorance in which, but for the timely purchase of the magazine, she might have entered Hillbridge. As he had, for instance, been densely unaware that Keniston had already had three Anners, and was showing symptoms of a fourth. She was equally ignorant of the fact that he had founded a school and created a formula. And she learned with a thrill that no one could hope to understand him who had not seen him in his studio at Hillbridge, surrounded by his own works. The man and the art interpret each other, their exponent declared. And Claudia Day, bending a brilliant eye on the future, wondered if she were ever to be admitted to the privilege of that double initiation. Keniston, to his other claims to distinction, added that of being hard to know. His friends always hastened to announce the fact to strangers, adding after a pause of suspense that they all see what they could do. Visitors in whose favor he was induced to make an exception were further warned that he never spoke unless he was interested, so that they mustn't mind if he remained silent. It was under these reassuring conditions that, some 10 days after her arrival at Hillbridge, Miss Day was introduced to the master's studio. She found him a tall, listless-looking man, who appeared middle-aged to her youth, and who stood before his own pictures with a vaguely interrogative gaze, leaving the task of their interpretation to the lady who had courageously contrived the visit. The studio, to Claudia's surprise, was bare and shabby. It formed a rambling addition to the small, cheerless house in which the artist lived with his mother and a widowed sister. For Claudia had added the last touch to his distinction to learn that he was poor, and that what he earned was devoted to the maintenance of the two limp women who formed a neutral-tinted background to his impressive outline. His pictures, of course, fetched high prices, but he worked slowly, painfully, as his devotees preferred to phrase it, with frequent intervals of ill health and inactivity, and the circle of Keniston connoisseurs was still as small as it was distinguished. The girl's fancy instantly hailed in him that favorite figure of imaginative youth, the artist who would rather starve than paint a potboiler. It is known to comparatively few that the production of successful potboilers is an art in itself, and that such heroic abstentions as Keniston's are not always purely voluntary. On the occasion of her first visit, the artist said so little that Claudia was able to indulge to the full the harrowing sense of her inadequacy. No wonder, as he had not been one of the few that he cared to talk to. Every word she uttered must so obviously have diminished the inducement. As he had been cheap, trivial, conventional, at once gushing and inexpressive, eager and constrained. She could feel him counting the minutes till the visit was over, and as the door finally closed on the scene of her discomfiture, she almost shared the hope with which she confidently credited him that they might never meet again. 2. Mrs. Davant glanced reverentially about the studio. I have always said, she murmured, that they ought to be seen in Europe. Mrs. Davant was young, credulous and emotionally extravagant. She reminded Claudia of her earlier self, the self that, 10 years before, had first set an awestruck foot on that very threshold. Not for his sake, Mrs. David continued, but for Europe's. Claudia smiled. She was glad that her husband's pictures were to be exhibited in Paris. She concurred in Mrs. David's view of the importance of the event, but she thought her visitor's way of putting the case a little overcharged. 10 years spent in an atmosphere of Keniston worship had insensibly developed in Claudia a preference for moderation of speech. She believed in her husband, of course. To believe in him, with an increasing abandonment and tenacity, had become one of the necessary laws of being, but she did not believe in his admirers. Their faith in him was perhaps as genuine as her own, but it seemed to her less able to give an account of itself. Some few of his appreciators doubtless measured him by their own standards. But it was difficult not to feel that in the Hillbridge circle, where rapture ran the highest, he was accepted on what was at best but an indirect valuation. And now and then, as he had a frightened doubt as to the independence of her own convictions, that innate sense of relativity which even Easton and Daigua had not been able to check in Claudia Day had been fostered in Mrs. Keniston by the artistic absolutism of Hillbridge. And she often wondered that her husband remained so uncritical of the quality of admiration accorded him. Her husband's uncritical attitude toward himself and his admirers had in fact been one of the surprises of her marriage. That an artist should believe in his potential power seemed to her at once the incentive and the pledge of excellence. She knew there was no future for a hesitating talent. What perplexed her was Keniston's satisfaction in his achievement. As he had always imagined that the true artist must regard himself as the imperfect vehicle of the cosmic emotion, that beneath every difficulty, overcome a new one lurked, the vision widening as the scope enlarged. To be initiated into these creative struggles, to shed on the toiler's path the consolatory ray of faith and encouragement, had seemed the chief privilege of her marriage. But there is something supererogatory in believing in a man obviously disposed to perform that service for himself, and Claudia's ardor gradually spent itself against the dense surface of her husband's complacency. She could smile now at her vision of an intellectual communion which should admit her to the inmost precincts of his inspiration. As he had learned that the creative processes are seldom self-explanatory, and Keniston's inarticulateness no longer discouraged her, but she could not reconcile her sense of the continuity of all high effort to his unperturbed air of finishing each picture, as though he had dispatched a masterpiece to posterity. In the first recoil from her disillusionment, she even allowed herself to perceive that, if he worked slowly, it was not because he mistrusted his powers of expression, but because he had really so little to express. "It's for Europe," Mrs. Davant vaguely repeated, and Claudia noticed that she was blushingly intent on tracing with the tip of her elaborate sunshade the pattern of the shabby carpet. "It will be a revelation to them," she went on provisionally, as though Claudia had missed her cue and left an awkward interval to fill. Claudia had in fact a sudden sense of deficient intuition. She felt that her visitor had something to communicate which required, on her own part, an intelligent cooperation, but what it was her insight failed to suggest. She was, in truth, a little tired of Mrs. Davant, who was Keniston's latest worshipper, who ordered pictures recklessly, who paid for them regally in advance, and whose gallery was, figuratively speaking, crowded with the artist's unpainted masterpieces. Claudia's impatience was perhaps complicated by the uneasy sense that Mrs. Davant was too young, too rich, too inexperienced, that somehow she ought to be warned. Warned of what? That some of the pictures might never be painted? Scarcely that, since Keniston, who was scrupulous in business transactions, might be trusted not to take any material advantage of such evidence of faith. Claudia's impulse remained undefined. She merely felt that she would have liked to help Mrs. Davant, and that she did not know how. "You'll be there to see them?" she asked, as her visitor lingered. "In Paris?" Mrs. Davin's blush deepened. We must all be there together. Claudia smiled. My husband and I mean to go abroad someday, but I don't see any chance of it at present. But you ought both to go this summer. Mrs. Davin persisted. I know Professor Wildmarsh and Professor Driffert, and all the other critics think that Mr. Keniston's never having been to Europe has given his work much of its wonderful individuality, its peculiar flavor and meaning, but now that his talent is formed, that he has full command of his means of expression. Claudia recognized one of Professor Driffert's favorite formulas. They all think he ought to see the work of the other great masters, that he ought to visit the home of his ancestors, as Professor Wildmarsh says. She stretched an impulsive hand to Claudia. Why, you ought to let him go, Mrs. Keniston. Claudia accepted the admonition with the philosophy of the wife who is used to being advised on the management of her husband. I shan't interfere with him, she declared. And Mrs. Davin instantly caught her up with a cry of, Oh, it's too lovely of you to say that. With this exclamation she left Claudia to a silent renewal of wonder. A moment later Keniston entered. To a mind curious in combinations it might have occurred that he had met Mrs. Davin on the doorstep. In one sense he might, for all his wife cared, have met 50 Mrs. Davins on the doorstep. It was long since Claudia had enjoyed the solace of resenting such coincidences. Her only thought now was that her husband's first words might not improbably explain Mrs. Davins' last, and she waited for him to speak. He paused with his hands in his pockets before an unfinished picture on the easel. Then, as his habit was, he began to stroll tourist-like from canvas to canvas, standing before each in a musing ecstasy of contemplation that no readjustment of view ever seemed to disturb. Her eye instinctively joined his in its inspection. It was the one point where their natures merged. Thank God, there was no doubt about the pictures. She was what she had always dreamed of being, the wife of a great artist. Keniston dropped into an armchair and filled his pipe. How should you like to go to Europe? He asked. His wife looked up quickly. When? Now this spring, I mean. He paused to light the pipe. I should like to be over there while these things are being exhibited. Claudia was silent. Well, he repeated after a moment. How can we afford it? She asked. Keniston had always scrupulously fulfilled his duty to the mother and sister whom his marriage had dislodged, and Claudia, who had the atoning temperament which seeks to pay for every happiness by making it a source of fresh obligations, had from the outset accepted his ties with an exaggerated devotion. Any disregard of such a claim would have vulgarized her most delicate pleasures. And her husband's sensitiveness to it in great measure extenuated the artistic obtuseness that often seemed to her like a failure of the moral sense. His loyalty to the dull women who depended on him was, after all, compounded of finer tissues than any mere sensibility to ideal demands. Oh, I don't see why we shouldn't, he rejoined. I think we might manage it. At Mrs. Davin's expense? Leaped from Claudia. She could not tell why she had said it. Some inner barrier seemed to have given way under a confused pressure of emotions. He looked up at her with frank surprise. He has been very jolly about it, why not? He has a tremendous feeling for art, the keenest I ever knew in a woman. Claudia imperceptibly smiled. She wants me to let her pay in advance for the 4 panels he has ordered for the Memorial Library. That would give us plenty of money for the trip, and my having the panels to do is another reason for my wanting to go abroad just now. Another reason? Yes, I've never worked on such a big scale. I want to see how those old chaps did the trick. I want to measure myself with the big fellows over there. An artist ought to, once in his life. She gave him a wondering look. For the first time his words implied a sense of possible limitation, but his easy tone seemed to retract what they conceded. What he really wanted was fresh food for his self-satisfaction. He was like an army that moves on after exhausting the resources of the country. Womanlike, she abandoned the general survey of the case for the consideration of a minor point. Are you sure you can do that kind of thing? She asked. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.